Welcome to Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Joseph Calewert, who is a knight commander of the French Order of Merit and was born in Belgium and educated in France. Now a U.S. citizen, he lives in Florida, where he enjoys life as an ardent historian of St. Paul the Apostle. He's written delightful travelogues about undiscovered France, as well as Lights Out for Freedom, a retelling of his youthful experiences of living in Belgium during 52 months of Nazi occupation. Joseph Calewert's engaging work on St. Paul reads like a novel, with inviting, even dramatic prose. It recounts the story of the great apostle to the nations. This is no dry tome or a ponderous biography, nor is its subject a safe historical figure, irrelevant to the issues of today. St. Paul remains controversial. Yet Calewert's work is not anti-scholarly. The World of St. Paul provides a popular yet expert account of the apostle and his age. For those who know little about St. Paul, which includes many Christians, it is a superb introduction. With Joseph Calewert, we go inside the pages of The World of St. Paul, published by Ignatius Press. Joseph, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you for your invitation.
The World of St. Paul, the recent book published by Ignatius Press, is wonderful. I have read other works on the life of St. Paul, but this one is like none other because there seems to be a, how do I want to put this, Joseph? You give us all of the depth of the information we need on his life, but it seems as though you have a great understanding of his heart. There seems to be a wonderful wholeness about the person that you bring to us in this great Apostle Paul.
Well, I hope to do so, and I hope to do so especially for the people, you know, the mainstream audience of Catholics and Christians. And they want to know more about St. Paul, but they are facing two things. One, they are introduced to him through the Acts from chapter 13 to 28, and that's easy reading. Mm-hmm. And then they go to the letters, and then they hit a big wall because the letters are dense, difficult to understand at times, sometimes badly translated. Mm-hmm. So you have to go back to Greek and the Koine Greek. And, of course, most people cannot do that. So I decided to try to help them out and also give them an idea of Paul, as like everybody else, you swim in your time. And Paul was swimming in the Hellenistic times, in other words, the Greek. He mm-hmm. was and surrounded by it. He was swimming in it. Mm-hmm. And he was not in Jerusalem, where he could have been protected. He was in the diaspora, as you know, mm-hmm. in Tarsus. So he absorbed the Greek Hellenistic time and culture, of course, but he stayed. He did not forget his religion, of course. He was a Jew to the end.
We can't even really begin the discussion until we talk about that great conversion of his. And I love the fact that you use the term metanoia,
yeah.
The metanoia, essentially, of Saul, because that word itself, I don't think we have a significant translation for it from that Greek.
There's no good translation. It's certainly not as a conversion, because he did not go from one. A conversion, usually in our mind, is you abandon what you were worshiping and you go to another one, which, of course, he never did. I would say he changed his side. The other side was, of course, Christian, but he remains Jewish. He remains a rabbi, although he did, and with all his knowledge. So it, metanoia is the word, and conversion is not a good translation.
Of course, the very, very first time we see him in scriptures, he's collecting coats at his feet at the stoning of the first martyr of the church, St. Stephen.
Yeah.
That particular incident, would that linger with him, do you think, or would that would have been just one more fulfillment of the righteousness of the law as he understood it?
I think it lingered. I think he did not participate, as you know. He was just watching, of course, but he agreed it. But he did not, maybe as a rabbi, he was already a rabbi at the time, maybe a rabbi could not throw stone, could not kill. Although I've asked rabbis and they've told me that, maybe they could have done it. He could have done it, but he didn't. Mm. So I think it Stephen, which is Stephanos' crown in Greek, must have had a very deep influence on him.
Mm. It's interesting that, as you point out, that he's on the road to Damascus at some point, and he has this experience. And Damascus, I mean, at the time had been called the Eye of the Desert.
That's right.
And it's interesting, he's struck blind.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk to us about that moment of his
It's interesting because it has been explained in different ways. Of course, the anti-clericals or the enemies explain it as just, you know, some kind of hallucination and so on. But we can forget that. He was walking. He was not on a horse. You see, sometimes they show St. Paul, you know, falling off his horse. But there never been talk of a horse anywhere. Mm-hmm. So it only came about in the 14th or 15th century. Mm-hmm. But so here he comes with a group. And suddenly there's a big light which takes the entire group. He's blinded and falls on the ground. And he hears a voice, as you know it. Mm-hmm. And they say, Paul, why do you persecute me? And he says, then, who are you, Lord? And he says, I'm Jesus, and so on. And then in one instant, and that's something which is amazing, in one instant, he understands that Jesus, the Christ, which he was pursuing through the Christians, mm-hmm. the Christian Jews at the time, he is the Messiah, the Christ, which afterwards he will use the word time and time again. Christos in Greek, Messiah in Hebrew or Aramaic. In other words, the Messiah the Jews have been waiting for, and now he has come and he wants to follow him. It's just simply amazing. After that, tries to stand up, but he cannot see. So they have to help him and bring him to the Damascus, to the house, and stay there, and didn't eat for 3 days. Mm-hmm. His new vocation has started, and of course you know how controversial he was all his life.
Joseph, I think when we talk about Paul being controversial, he was at that time, even amongst the apostles, the teachers, the disciples of that day, and what the message he had to communicate. And he's controversial today.
That's right. He has been controversial all through the centuries and will be for the rest until kingdom come. You see, only mollusks are non-controversial. Hmm. Anybody with some character is controversial. He was controversial against his because of his enemies. His enemies didn't like it, of course. The Roman authorities didn't like him because he was disturbing the peace. And then among his own people, I mean by that, the Christians, Jewish Christians, and let's call them the new Christian, pagan Christians, he was also controversial. And among the Jewish Christians, right away, he was in trouble with, for example, James the Lesser, who didn't like him too much, or his entourage probably. But, and so they were saying, oh, well, the big question was, should we accept pagans and allow them not to follow the law? And you know, there were 613 things they could not do or should do, and also whether they should be circumcised as if they were men. So it was a difficult question, which was, of course, solved, and to a point. He stood up to Peter when Peter agreed to not eat with the Christian pagans, because they might have eaten the meats which were offered to the gods. In other words, he got in trouble all the time. But this is a sign of great sanctity, I would say, because when I look around and look at the history, the life of the saints, they always are also controversial. And it looks to me like the Lord makes them pay for their success, so that they keep to be very, very humble.
Yes,
and not think they have done it themselves, all by themselves.
He was kept humble, that is for sure. And how we know about so much of Paul are from a couple of different things from Scripture. Of course, the accounts written in the Acts of the Apostles by, could we say, his friend, the physician Luke, who would travel with Paul, and so we learn much about the geographical locations that
also,
he visited and some of the struggles within that community.
Yeah.
But then it's reading Paul himself. I mean, when we read Paul, we learn much about him, and there are the letters, there's the epistles. There, I mean, what is the difference then in those?
Well, people were thinking that you have letters and epistles, and they thought there was a difference. Letters were something which would be more for, let's say, diffusion to a great number of people, and letters would be more something more like for individuals. But now, if you look at two words, epistle comes from the Greek epistole, which means a letter.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one comes from the Latin lettere, which is always in plural, lettere, letters in plural.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same thing, in other words. It's one is a Greek and one is Latin, and there's no difference, and we should not make difference between the two.
I'm glad you're saying that, because I've read some of the different books that have come out recently about St. Paul, not necessarily written by those who ascribe to the Catholic tradition of our understanding of him, but those who are considered modern biblical scholars, and they've just, as they did with the historical Jesus, which they tried to just dissect it down to where his divinity is almost, when you read them, is nil. It's null and void. You end up reading the same thing they do to St. Paul. They try to ascribe to him somehow that he invented Christianity, and somehow he isn't the figure which is given to us in those scriptures.
Yes. Well, you know, this is an interesting point, because, first of all, you know, we have had the biblical criticism of the Bible for 200 years. Mm-hmm. And it's mostly, I always felt that it was always to try to demolish Paul, or to demolish his letters, or whatever. And then the latest has been, you know, Paul is the inventor of Christianism. And that's a pure invention, because it's a definite no, he did not. He is not the inventor of the central ideas, tenets of Christianism. That's what Jesus did before he was involved. And then, if he has a doctrine, it comes just straight from Ancient Testament and Judaism.
Mm.
And if you look at his Christology, which is what, you know, the definition of the personality, the person of Christ, And now all this has its roots in the primitive church of Jerusalem. If you look at Acts in the beginning, in chapter 2 to about 4, I would think, it's definitely the roots, and he did not invent that. Mm-hmm. The title, or for example, in Greek he mentions Kurios, which means, of course, Lord. And that's something, and you encounter in his, I think, 362 times in his letters. And this is to be found in every Palestinian or Syriac before him. Then they will say, well, he invented the doctrine of the Holy Spirit. But that was, again, it has biblical roots long before Paul was born. And then, of course, the doctrine of justification. And he develops that, and that's why the Protestant likes him so much, because he defines, you know, that what counts is the grace and justification by grace, and I don't need the church for that. I can do it on my own. But this doctrine already had its origin in Palestinian Judaism. So I would say Paul was a genius. So the Lord created Paul as a religious genius, and then he broke the mold. There is no one like Paul, except, of course, to a point, Peter, and of course Christ. Mm-hmm. And he is an interpreter, genial interpreter, and not a creator of what the world. He gave Christianism a proper doctrinal system, but he did not create.
I would like to ask you, as someone who is an ardent historian of Paul, but you have obviously read him, studied him, and I think you've probably prayed with him as well.
Yes.
How would you describe his possible response to some of, first, the Protestant attempt to use him and his doctrine, quote unquote, of justification as a way to cause such disunity and division from the church established by Jesus Christ?
Well, first of all, if you go back to the original founders of the Reformation, they did not have that in mind. It came only later. Mm-hmm. In other words, the Protestants of the Reformation were not the Protestants later on, which then made it very, they wanted to get rid of the Catholic Church. For example, I would say Luther, in the beginning, did not want to leave the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. He just wanted to reform within the Catholic Church. But then, later on, the Protestants wanted to get away from the Catholic Church and have nothing to do. So they had to establish a kind of system that would explain why they, based on St. Paul's, based on his letters, and to establish their own religion, which they did. Mm-hmm. And it was a break. I've discovered in the last few years, I would say, or maybe the 10 years, that the Protestants, even the Protestants, are coming back and are trying to reread the Reformation. And also, not only the Reformation, the Reformers, and what they wrote, but also the Middle Age, like St. Thomas of Aquinas, and also the Father of the Church. Mm-hmm. They are rediscovering it, and it's a good sign.
It is. I mean, the fathers would draw upon the teachings of St. Paul, and I just, there is, there just seems to be this beautiful, long connection with him. I mean, he was such an important, extremely important figure. I just have to say, Joseph, that in reading your work, and also, it reminds me of that time when I, and I'm sure you've probably been to Rome as well.
Oh, yeah.
That when you visit, of course, there's St. Peter's, located the Vatican, and Mary Major and John Lateran, and the great basilica churches within the walls of Rome, and are very glorious. And then you go to St. Paul's outside the walls,
which is Le Mura.
Yes, the other, the church which is located, as it said, outside the wall. And there is,
yes,
a peace and a serenity,
yes,
about that particular basilica, unlike the others. And I have a sense that's, here we are, Paul, once again, he's outside of that center of what, you know, the hub of Christianity. But look at the work that he did. Even there, he's kind of an I don't want to say outsider, but there's something very special about him.
Yes, he was a kind of outsider, because the amazing thing is that, first of all, coming back to the St. Paul outside the walls, as I say in the preface of my book, that's where I got the idea, or not the idea, but the decision to write that book. It's the, as you say, it's an empty church,
mm-hmm,
but it feels like you are in paradise,
mm-hmm,
almost.
Mm-hmm.
I say almost, and it's so different, as you say, from the other churches. And Paul was, in a sense, an outsider, because if you think that, normally, you see, when the church began, you had, and in the Acts of the Apostles, it says so, there was Peter, there was John, and there was James. So it looks like this was, you know, Peter was the rock, John was the favorite disciple, and James was a strong personality.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly, John is pushed aside, and here comes a man who was an enemy, and Christ puts him in charge of the, as apostle of the nations.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it makes no sense. He's an outsider coming in, and he takes over. Not the church, but the missionary activities. Strange. But the ways of God, of the Holy Ghost, mm-hmm, are to us very strange.
He is. He's such a wonderful figure. And again, to really get to know him, all the different facets, or at least maybe a whole is too much. Maybe we won't always know everything about this complicatedly wonderful man, but many of the facets can be gleaned from reading his writing. And
yes.
Do you have one or two in particular, letters, epistles, however you want to call it,
yes,
that stand out for you?
Yeah, well, it depends. It's difficult. It's normally I like the Philippians very much, for maybe, let's say, two reasons. One, it's he loved them. Two, he never had trouble with them. And three, they give him financial support. So his letter to them is a beauty,
mm-hmm,
because he doesn't have to shout. He doesn't have to tell them what not to do and explain. It's a beautiful. On the other hand, if you want to see, you know, Galatians is interesting too, and of course the 7,100 words of Romans.
Mm.
And sometimes Romans is a problem with for me, because he writes to them as if he knew them, mm-hmm. and yet he had never been there apparently before. But that's something I want to find out later.
mm-hmm. Yeah, something to explore. The depths of St. Paul and just his experience. And I just highly, highly recommend The World of St. Paul. And Joseph, I wish we had more time, because this has just been wonderful. But any final thoughts?
A final one? Mm-hmm. I will tell you. First of all, know your St. Paul, his life, and his world. Two, read his letters, and you will see the gleaming sword of his intellect flashing. And three, listen to his letters and hear the love of St. Paul for Jesus Christ and the people of God, Jews and Gentiles. These are the three things I want to say.
Beautiful. Joseph, thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you very much for inviting me again. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We've been going inside the pages of The World of St. Paul with Joseph Calaver. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to Ignatius.com, the website for Ignatius Press, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and download this discussion along with many others, go to www.discerninghearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.